Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. This is Greg Blaze, your host. As St. Patrick's Day approaches here in the U.S., there winds up being a big focus on the Irish art of drinking beer. I'm from outside Boston. I spent a lot of time there, and I get it. Here at Cutting the Curd, what excites us about this holiday is the chance to focus on Irish cheese for a minute. And who better to help us navigate that world than our guest today, Seamus Sheridan, co-owner of Sheridan's Cheesemongers in Ireland. Hi, Seamus. Welcome to Cutting the Curd, and thanks for calling in so late at night over there.
It's not too late, Greg. Can you hear me?
I can hear you great. You and I first met at the Crevero home for Wayward Cheesemongers back in the day. We slung some vino out together, and we had a great time.
Well.
Yeah, that was a great time, as it always is. That's sort of like more drinking than I maybe did on several St. Patrick's days. I don't know about you, but that's a great place to be.
We've been stereotyped again, aren't we?
Yeah.
For Irish, yeah.
Well, I'm Swedish, you know, so we also like to drink quite a bit. And, you know, I'm a member of a Swedish social club, and, you know, we call each other dumb Swedes all the time, but if anybody else does...
I won't stereotype people from the States at all, then.
We're the best and the worst. So let's get right to the heart of it, man. What Irish cheeses are you most excited about right now?
Well, Irish cheeses, they remain quite stable.
Yeah.
Well, myself and Kevin started about 20-odd years ago. And slowly one or two new cheeses come. But by and large, we still rely on the cheeses that have been around for the last 20 years. So it's quite which means that it's quite a difficult business to break into for young kids or young people starting up.
That's pretty good. So
there are always beautiful cheeses coming up, and sometimes they don't survive.
Yeah.
So the newest cheese that I really like at the moment is a cheddar called Derg Cheddar.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of exciting me from the new batch of Irish cheeses.
And you're talking the old schoolers are like the Gubeen, the Coulé, the Duras, Ardrahan, Cashel, the Titans.
Malines, of course.
Yeah.
You got it exactly right. Then you got the Cashel Blue, the Crozier Blue.
Yeah, man.
And then over the last couple of years, we've got a blue called Young Buck. You know, a few younger cheesemakers come through.
Yeah. Do you still make the Heather? Is that still made over there?
No.
Yeah, that was the lost one. I really liked that. It was like a little Boucheron type of goat cheese, I believe. A little like
Annelise Bartig. Myself came out a book a few years ago. One chapter dedicated to her.
Yeah.
And in a strange way, it's a nice chapter because the whole chapter is dedicated to her giving up making cheese.
That's an unfortunate chapter. That's not good. Then does a cheese called Mizzen still get made over there?
No, that's kind of a legend. Yeah, that's made by an American gentleman and legend of Irish cheese called, Bill Hogan.
Yeah.
And then Bill made Mizzen and Gabriel. And And they were thermophilic cheeses.
Yes.
And then myself and Bill spent 2 years in the courts fighting for his cheese, which was a great learning curve.
It's interesting. Like sometimes here in the U.S., I think, and a lot of it has to do because of the Neal's Yard Dairy is the way a lot of people get their really high quality cheese from the aisles over there. The Irish cheeses get grouped together with the English cheeses. But how different are the cheese making traditions?
Neal's Yard Dairy have always done that, and who are we to even challenge Neal's Yard Dairy because they're so brilliant at what they do?
Right.
So myself and Kevin never really tried to export cheeses that Neil Jarrett will carry. That said, we export a lovely small washed rind cheddar type cheese called 15 Fields.
15 Fields.
Yeah, which is made by Eamon Lonergan here in Ireland. We mature it for him. So we sell a bit of that into the States. You know, it trickles into different cheesemongers here and there.
Completely. Are the would you say that the cheesemaking traditions in England and Ireland are similar, or are they? Does Ireland have its own independent history of cheesemaking?
Yes, very much so. Okay, so let's just focus on that then. That's interesting. So you know the story when you go to the continental Europe.
Yes,
cheeses are named after certain areas, and there are lots of hopefully 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 cheesemakers in that area, and they make that cheese, you know, called after the region.
Certainly.
In England, because of the old landowning system with the gentry and farmers, there always was a very large landowning class in England.
Certainly.
That can go back hundreds of years. So if you take the legendary Montgomery cheddar, it's a perfect example. I don't know how many hundreds of years the Montgomery farm has been in control of that farm, but it's a long time. Whereas if you look at Irish farming, in a lot of areas, we really only became independent farmers in around 1920,
sure.
1930, you know, when we became an independent country from the UK.
Sure.
So most of our, in our new, bright new future, most of our dairy production went into co-ops.
Sure.
And
understood.
Those co-ops grew like you would have the Wisconsin cheese. You could trade exactly the same way.
Absolutely. And, the English, they have the territorials. That's usually how it is. And that territory is generally a family name. So it's like its own sort of miniaturized PDO system. And so the Irish are cooperative dairying, but the cheeses are still named in a territorial fashion. But that's probably the only thing that they are similar.
So we had the co-ops. I was always wondering, so a reason why the co-ops have become so industrialized, I think, is that they were supplier co-op.
Okay.
They were never worker co-ops.
Huh.
So the co-ops were controlled by the people who supplied the milk.
Yeah.
Not by the workers. So, you know, when you look at European co-ops, they would be worker-owned co-ops. Correct. Yeah. So there's a difference between so that's, I think, why they took that march towards corporatization and conglomeration.
It makes sense. And you say it's interesting. For the cheeses that don't make it out for export, like does that dairying system, does that have anything to do with it?
We export huge proportion. Our biggest success story is the country, of course, we carry gold butter.
Yeah, of course. That's everywhere.
Okay. And then the companies, the Irish Dairy Board, or NUA, as they're called now, the old co-ops grouped together. And they set up a company called the Irish Dairy Board.
Yeah.
And they all work together to export our butter under the Kerrygold label. And
certainly.
There's various types of cheese.
Certainly.
Even ones that don't sound Irish, like Pilgrim and Cathedral.
Yeah, but they
will be made in Ireland. And they have different names depending on what region of the States you are. And
it's
quite hard to keep track of it all. So that would be the big Wisconsin-type cheddar production. Then in the 1970s, I'm sure everybody knows who's listening to your program anyway, will know that that's when we started up our independent cheesemakers.
Excellent.
So they would have been a small farmstead who decided to start making cheese themselves.
Interesting. I mean, when I look at cheese, it's a general question, but it's along those same lines of the traditions of cheesemaking. Cheese, I've always, as I've learned through doing this podcast, just being a cheesemonger for a long time, cheese is there to add value to the milk. It's there to give a source for dairying, you know, places to give their product, and it appreciates in value, and that system is allowed to coexist. In America...
You've got to add in subsidies. That's the big question,
right.
Isn't it? Like, so you see in the States and in Europe, the amount of money that we subsidize dairy production,
right?
That enabled very cheap cheese to get to the market.
Yeah.
And where our farmstead cheesemakers, even though they are subsidized part of their production, it's a smaller percentage of their overall price to the market.
Yeah.
And we know all the politics that comes in with that, and the local employment, et cetera, taste,
completely.
Quality, love, passion, life itself.
Yeah. It's really
interesting. Yeah, at the basis of that is in the States and in Europe, we are too rich to milk our own cows.
Well, that's the thing. There's a lot of cheese, especially that's made in the United States now, and it's made in essence as a hobby. They're like, there's in such an excess here, which even though we cry poverty, that people say, oh, yeah, there's milk readily available and there's this abandoned farm. We're going to buy it because, you know, we've made money and we're going to go and make cheese. I think that's okay. But I think it's fantastic. But I always think it's important to take a look at the history of why these things come to be. When you're telling me, you know, the two cheese making traditions are very different because in a very short time ago, Ireland, you know, got its independence to do those sorts of things. And you really see what cheese making does as a method of preserving people's lives and way of life. Would you agree?
Yeah, we never really had it. I mean, Ireland was very famous for producing salted meat and butter,
right?
You know, for the navies of the world.
Yeah.
Then the bloody Argentinians, remember them?
Yes,
They started competing with us for the beef and came up with the tins, putting stuff in tins. This nonsense. The years before our independence. So cheese making itself is I would say it's not really been there.
Yeah.
It came in with our large co-ops, obviously.
Sure.
And then it was the mid-1970s before we got individuals back in making cheese themselves.
That's awesome. That's awesome to hear that. I want to ask you, just because I'm selfish and I get to ask you whatever questions I want. There's one of my favorite cheeses ever in the world. It's such an odd little cheese, and it comes from Ireland, and I can never, ever get it anymore. And it was just called the Dingle. And it came to me from Dingle, and it had a piece of kelp running through it. And like all of these like roots. Does that still get made?
You can still get a seaweed. I'll post you over some.
I love that.
Some Dillis cheese.
Yeah.
There's nobody listening from the government. Yeah, I'll post it over to you.
That's amazing. Why is the kelp there? What's the history of that? And what are all those runes?
Dillis is a type of seaweed.
Yes.
I grew up in the city, but my mom grew up in the farm.
Yeah.
So she brought me up there. Once or twice I went before school holidays ended.
Yeah.
So I'm a inner city little guy, you know, and I go to this country school with just two rooms.
Yeah, sure.
And the kids, they weren't chewing chewing gum, you know, they were chewing seaweed.
Yeah, yeah.
Behind the teacher's back. Wow.
Sure. That sounds good.
I remember that in my childhood.
I did a few things behind my teacher's
that's
back.
That's seaweed, yeah.
That's cool. And obviously that's where it's from. That's just like a mythical place. And anybody I ever talked to...
There's a lot of nonsense. I study seaweed a lot. There's a lot of nonsense talking about seaweed.
Yeah.
Because it's the most exciting area for me in seaweed is plastic, and that's potential there.
Yeah.
But there's very few things that seaweed's actually good at. And one of them is the Irish brown bread, when you put it in the brown bread.
Sure.
And it does actually taste good in the cheese as well.
Yeah, it does. It was really, really cool stuff.
It actually works as opposed to pretending it's something cool.
It's very odd. It's very odd. And then I would always run into these Irish surfers, and they would be like, oh, yeah, you're going to be crazy to surf in the Dingle. And I was like, yeah, I think people from there are crazy anyway because they give me cheese with fucking seaweed in the middle of it. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But an interesting place. So... All right, so we'll go back to St. Patrick's Day for a second. Since St. Patrick's Day is a bit of a drinking holiday here in the U.S., I'm one excited to ask, what are your go-to Irish beer and cheese pairings? But also, what are your best cheeses to have with whiskey, which is the Irish export that I probably have consumed the most of in my life?
Okay, let's start with the whiskey.
Sure.
I tried.
Sure.
I tried, and I tried again.
Yeah.
And then I tried again.
Uh-huh.
So I just think, like, if you're sitting beside the fire and you want to drink whiskey and you want to have some cheese, do it.
Okay.
Don't worry about pairing it. I mean,
I would agree with that.
The Americans say you're too much into your pairing.
Yeah,
More enjoyment is what I would say. So, but I would introduce a grain between the consumption of the whiskey and the eating of the cheese.
Sure. That makes sense.
So we have our brown bread crackers, our kind of buttermilk crackers you make here.
Yeah.
So, you know, you see them over there in the States as well. When I was in whiskey tastings, I would taste the whiskey, then I would cleanse my palate or break my palate with a kind of cheese cracker that way.
Yep.
And then I'd eat the cheese. But here's a funny thing. So I tried to pretend like a proper man, like from Basque, Spain, you know?
Okay.
So it's a shame. It's a company real man. So I had all these whiskeys that they were making a film about me eating cheese and whiskey.
Uh-huh.
So I got Duras cheese.
Uh-huh.
a fork,
okay,
some whiskey,
yeah,
the bean, fork whiskey,
maybe, yeah,
fork whiskey, Crozier Blue.
Oh, yeah, that's a good whiskey. One.
The Crozier Blue, the Sheep's Blue.
Yeah.
The first three cheeses, that was not a good thing.
But the blue was good, right? Yeah.
Yeah, the Grubine, the Durris, the Malines did not take the maximum of whiskey and left for a couple of weeks on the shelf.
Sure, sure.
But my God, that Crozier Blue.
Yeah. Wow. That was, yeah.
It became one. It became the most beautiful.
Totally.
Amazing.
Totally.
And dare I say, proper machismo taste.
Yeah.
An up-to-taste sensation.
That's cool.
So that was an interesting little aside from whiskey and cheese. So yeah, Sheep's Blue, mixed in with the whiskey.
Excellent. I did a few tastings back when I was a younger man at this good bar in the East Village, it's called DBA, and they've been around for a long time. They had a big whiskey selection. I would bring Harborne Blue, old Harborne Blue, and have that with a bunch of Irish and Scotch whiskey.
Yeah, well, it's like that, isn't it? I would go tend to it's blue with whiskey, wouldn't you?
Yeah, definitely.
It has to be.
Cool. We're going to take a tiny break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk to Seamus about his awesome shop in Ireland. Stay with us for a sec.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the Farmstead Cheese Company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sertori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back here to Cutting the Curd, broadcasting live on the Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Greg Blaze, and I'm here with Seamus Sheridan, co-owner of Sheridan's Cheesemongers, talking about cheese in Ireland and other interesting things, whiskey.
Seamus, I'm still here, Greg. I'm still here.
I'm so happy that you are, and thank you. Now that we've gotten your full take or a fuller take on the state of cheese in Ireland, let's talk about your own experience. You founded Sheridan's Cheesemongers with your brother in the 90s and originally sold farmhouse cheeses at the Galway Market. Now your business includes four different shops around Ireland, and you also produce your own insanely good crackers. Did you always know you wanted to grow the business like this?
It just kept happening, I think, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of myself, my brother's drive. We opened in Dublin, and then we couldn't get cheese that we wanted into Ireland, so we started importing it, and then we started exporting our food cheese out, and that therefore we needed a warehouse. And
sure.
And then we never really owned any property or anything like that. We rented our shops. Then we bought a train station.
Okay.
That's our headquarters down in Meath. And, you know, the business grew that way.
Sure, you filled the need.
And we've got four stalls, you know, like Murray's doing the big stores over there. We've four or five supermarket counters as well.
That's pretty awesome. Am I right that you and your brother still run the business together along with your third partner, Fiona?
Yeah. Well, Kev runs the business. I just off, I'm afraid. But,
okay. Okay.
No, I'm here in Galway on the West Coast. So.
Awesome. Is it challenging to run a business with your sibling, or does that make it easier in some ways?
Well, it depends on it. I think, there's no generalization there. I get on incredibly well with Kevin, always have. So,
yeah.
we're very close that way.
Yeah, my sister and I are thinking of doing that. She's, you know, we want to work together and sell some cheese together, and we're really close. We're really good friends. She's probably my best friend, and and she puts up with me, and I think we can do it together. But there really isn't a generalization. Sometimes it works, and sometimes it's the end of the family, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's cool.
Well, we really enjoy it, and there are obviously lots and lots and lots of tough times, but then there are just some amazing times.
Yeah.
Like when I'm pouring Prosecco with you in Giorgio Cavero's courtyard. Or
yeah, man.
We have a food festival every year down the country in our headquarters, and we stand together and see 4,000 or 5,000 people walking around.
That's pretty awesome.
Oh, my goodness. Look what we did.
Yeah, and it's your family, you know? Like, that's the thing.
Yeah.
When you go home from a job and you try to explain to your family or something, they had the best day at work, and they're like, yeah, but it's work. But when it's your...
A really funny story is we're first generation. So,
yeah.
You know, when you go to Italy, everybody's like fifth generation?
Yeah, sure.
So, I knew you'd say Giorgio's father, Carlos, for those listening here, that's our Parmesan dealer, my best friend, my Italian
friend. Amazing, man.
So my father's a inner city working class guy, car factory, and he comes to Slow Food to Bra in Italy, and walks around with Giorgio's father.
Yeah.
Whereas all the big famous Italian cheese companies presume that he's the big don, you know.
Yeah.
So myself and Giorgio were like watching from a high through the months, and we saw
guys
getting kicked off a table as my father entered the
room.
And cheese has been thrown out in front of him. With Giorgio's father, and the two of them were just laughing, pretending.
That's the best. That's pretty fucking great. That's really awesome. What do you have any advice to give to any of our listeners, even me, who might be dreaming of opening their own local cheese shop?
Yeah, you gotta. I mean, if you do the cheese shop, then you're pure retail. But you gotta watch your margins there.
Yeah.
I had a great Jewish jeweler next door to me for years. He passed away. We had great crack together. One of the last things he said to me, he opened the door of the shop and said, Shamey. Yes, Mr. Danker. He said, do you know why I'm going to die rich and you're going to die poor? I believe in silver. You believe in cheeses.
I like it.
Look, your stuff's evaporating.
Totally.
Your profit margin.
Yeah. I try to explain that.
You don't want
to
be elitist. That's the big problem with being a cheesemonger, is you don't want to appear to be just, there for the rich people.
Totally.
There's always that in your head. How do you...
Totally, but you got to go where the money is, though.
Accessible?
You have to... People have to buy it, and sometimes it's not inexpensive. I actually agree with that 100%, and it's been a problem. I mean, my mom and dad are awesome people, My mom's a teacher, My dad worked a lot. I mean, but it's the same. I'm not a whatever passes for the gentry here in the U.S., I love to be an American and who I am and how I got to grow up.
Yeah,
but
the supermarket tent is, strangely enough, I've opened up our cheese a bit to a different market that we're quite surprised at the volumes we're doing there.
Totally.
Really good, like the beans and up the really good cheeses.
Yeah.
So the advice is, if you're wholesale, you got to look after your credit.
Yeah, fucking get those bills paid, man.
And if you're just purely retailing, then it's just customer service and giving that joy to people when they come into the cheese shop. It's one of the few shops left in the world, isn't it, that you get that tasting.
I agree.
You don't go into a tobacco shop and they let you taste 20
different
cigarettes.
No, that's the thing.
Go to a whiskey shop and let you taste 20 different. You know what I mean?
No, it's true.
What do you want to taste?
And it's a different interaction. Like you are, you're in charge there. I mean, all the people that I've been able to interact with over the counter, doesn't matter who they are or what they are. I remember when we were in Italy and Leon Panetta came in. He's like the head of the CIA, and he's like immediately was drawn over there, to the counter, and they're just like staying. They're not the CIA. I think he is actually. Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
And he comes down, and these guys that are walking past, and he was just like drawn to the cheese counter, and I was like, you want some cheese, dude? And he's like, hell yeah, And then I'm like feeding the guy out of my hand, and it's just like, Like that, where else?
No, there's so many, serving behind the counter is an amazing thing.
Yeah.
And then, like, for me, from when we were started off, visiting our cheesemakers, that was so special,
Yeah.
Visiting for the first time.
Totally.
I was in tears, finding all these beautiful people making cheese.
It's the best world, man.
And in relationship with them. And, it's just such a beautiful
such a beautiful job.
Yeah, it's the best, man. It's the only one I'll ever have till they put me in the ground. Some of our listeners most likely know that your crackers are exported to the U.S., but we actually have listeners all over the world. Do you export the crackers to other countries as well? And you have any plans to expand that?
Yeah, worldwide now.
That's awesome.
Which makes you seem like a really successful businessman, which I'm not.
Whatever.
But it's a lot of thanks because Adam Moskowitz, kindly, you all know who he is.
He's the
man.
He kindly
let us import some records himself, so he could piggyback them onto all the good cheese shops
sure.
that use him for importing.
Sure.
So we got a good distribution in the States that way. And then you had two different channels then in Australia and Japan and the UK and Europe.
It's awesome.
Yeah, that was something that happened kind of by accident and something we're very proud of.
Yeah. Sometimes the best shit happens that way. The best stuff, those little mistakes that are, that turned into that, or those little windfalls, those are the best for me anyway. Look, I could talk Irish cheese and talk with you for hours, but unfortunately we're just about out of time. I want to thank you, Seamus, for joining us on the show today.
Yeah, that wasn't long enough, Greg. But listen, hi to all our customers and friends over there.
Yeah.
And while you're drinking on St. Patrick's Day, we will be out milking cows, drinking cold tea and drinking pints of buttermilk.
I'm going to leave you with that. Don't forget. I'm Greg Blaze. We'll be back next week with more Cutting the Curd. Thanks, Seamus. Later.
Okay, Greg. Mind yourself. Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.